This is Kurt Anderson, and you're not listening to Studio 360 for hard news, for stories about war and crime and politics. You're listening for what we usually talk about here, the music and art and ideas and whole cities that talented people create and the rest of us adore. Works of art that allow us to experience the world more deeply or differently, that give us glimpses into other minds and lives and imaginary realms and connect us to other people. In other words, you're here for stories about our culture. But last week, it was our culture that was the target of war and crime and politics. I came to LA to make rock and roll. Along the way, I had to sell my soul. I made some good friends that make me say, I really want to be in LA. This song is not what anybody would call provocative. Just a bit of good, harmless pop from a Southern California band called Eagles of Death Metal. They were on stage at the Bataclan Theater in Paris. The band escaped, but 89 of their fans were murdered, as were dozens of other Parisians targeted as they enjoyed a night out at cafes and a soccer match. Shortly after the massacres, France's National Assembly met. They had a moment of silence, and then they all started singing. And in the days following, people all over the world started singing that song too, at theaters, in public squares. This was their response to the murderous true believers who just attacked Beirut and a university in Kenya as well. Jihadists who declared war on culture.
It is a culture generally that prides itself on its openness and also in a public sphere that is very visible.
Rafia Zakaria is a Pakistani-American columnist for Al Jazeera America. I reached her in Oslo.
The cafe culture, and enjoying the company of friends and loved ones in these public spaces is very integral to European society. And so to strike at the heart of it is very clever. I mean, you can feel a very palpable sense of suspicion and paranoia here.
Zakaria says that in Paris last week, instead of going after major landmarks, the terrorists decided to target fun. Which may at first sound like a trivial notion, but as she says, fun is essential to life. Culture, among other things, is about having fun.
And when you eviscerate fun, and when you do it in a way that is so visible and hence traumatizes not simply the people who are there, but all the rest of us who are watching this, you say that that part of human existence does not have the justification to exist. Fun is a delicate thing, and you can create secure environments, but they are likely no longer spontaneous or fun, because once fun is tainted by paranoia, it's no longer the same thing.
We are a little afraid, but I think we must continue to see all this cultural life in Paris.
Last weekend in Paris, almost all of the scheduled concerts were canceled, the museums closed. But as soon as they reopened, Parisians were there. One of the first bands to retake the stage was the English pop group Simply Red. Remember them from the 80s? And people were lined up down the street.
You don't stop doing the things you love. You don't stop going to see the groups you love.
It's so important. There is a real Paris spirit, and especially regarding this kind of problem. And so sad for everybody. So we have to be strong, and we will be.
After the 9/11 attacks in New York, did the New Yorkers stop going to the Metropolitan Museum?
No.
So it's the same thing. 10 years ago, we had an attack in London at the tube station. Londoners continued their lives. Sadly, we've all been through it. They had it in Spain. Life goes on.
I want to read you something. We are a profoundly secular city, people free to worship their own gods or to be godless. Blasphemy is common. Irreverence is obligatory. Art is at least as important as religion. Eccentric ideas and profane entertainment flourish. That's something I wrote 14 years ago for Time magazine in the days just after 9/11 about New York City. But rereading it for the first time since then, it feels like I could have written it last week about Paris. There are some apt phrases in French for what that made me feel. I'm thinking of déjà vu and plus ça change. Like France now, in the days following the 2001 attacks, the United States retaliated by bombing the terrorists in the Middle East. And then, feverishly, inevitably, we went to war. In 2003, just as we were about to invade Iraq, one of my intellectual heroes came into the studio, the late Susan Sontag. We talked about Homer's depiction of one of the first long, terrible, organized killing sprees in the Mediterranean, the Trojan War.
Homer treats war as something that's just part of human activity. It's something awful, but it exists. It's something people do. It's something people want to do, as painful and awful as it is.
I asked her about when and why civilized people finally moved beyond that fatalistic sense of inevitability about righteous mass killing into deep outrage, even when we weren't the victims. And she said it was a painter who helped us see and think about war differently a couple hundred years ago.
Goya is a kind of turning point. I think what's interesting about Goya, what's magnificent and admirable about Goya, is that these are images of protest. They're not just showing us what is horrible. They are saying, this shouldn't happen. I don't think Homer is saying this shouldn't happen. I don't think Shakespeare is saying this shouldn't happen in Henry V, for instance, which is
quite the opposite almost.
Right, quite the opposite. I don't think there's any protest really to speak of in the representation of these conflicts until the beginning of the 19th century and until Goya. I think Goya is a kind of turning point. Goya is actually saying we should be horrified. We should not just find this horrible. We should be horrified. We should protest. We should deplore. We should take a moral position.
And which of his paintings do you find the most moving in its or
well,
full of impact?
What he shows in this series of images is tremendous sadistic cruelties of soldiers against civilians. And Goya is reacting to a new kind of war, a new kind of war on European soil at any rate. And what he shows are the most awful things. I mean, people being dismembered, hanging, people who are hanged who have had their limbs amputated. What's so striking in these Goya images are the captions, which apparently are by Goya himself, where he says things like, "Can you believe it? Can you look at this? This is impossible to look at."
But of course, art can also be deployed to glorify and encourage war. And these terrorists today are doing exactly that.
I'm Bernard Haeckel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University.
Haeckel co-wrote an article in The New Yorker about jihadi poets, writers who are well known among members of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, who eulogize the dead and radicalize the willing.
You know, this is a movement that is sustained by a narrative. A narrative of victimization, of humiliation of Muslims, of the ability of this movement to bring glory and power back to Muslims, and also a memorialization of the great deeds of the movement's heroes and dead martyrs, quote unquote. So, you know, all of that has to be put in some cultural form in order to transmit this knowledge, this memory, and this history of the movement from, you know, one generation to the next, from the older fighters to the younger fighters, and they're prolific in doing this.
And from your descriptions of their poetry, for all of their postmodern use of the internet and videos and everything, the poetry is in this is kind of
archaic.
Archaic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a production of a form of archaic culture. Because you see, they are trying to say that we are like the original the first generations of Muslims who lived in the 7th and 8th century of the Common Era. And those Muslims, we know from the historical record, engaged in poetry and had a culture. And so the ISIS people are trying to reproduce that culture in some claim for authenticity, that
right.
we are the real thing.
Right.
You know? And unlike these other corrupted Muslims who have taken on Western culture or who have forgotten who Muslims really are and ought to be.
Yeah. And they share this poetry, for instance, like they do their videos online?
Yeah, on social media, yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And these poems are memorized, and then they're often recited by fighters when they're sitting around and between battles.
Really?
Hanging out. Yeah, absolutely.
In other words, ISIS knows full well the power of culture to shape minds.
In fact, their loss of territory and their loss of battles, in particular against the Kurds, but also the Iraqi government forces, has meant that they're looking increasingly like losers.
Right.
So they need to have, quote-unquote, successful attacks. They need
right.
to bring themselves back into the limelight as the great warriors of Islam and defenders of the religion. So the Paris attack has done this. And you can see this immediately when the attack was happening. I mean, there were thousands of tweets by supporters and people celebrating while the attacks were happening. So, you know, you cannot capitulate to them.
Right.
But you have to be able to alter their narrative and make it ring hollow with their followers.
You know who else has followers?
Nothing about what these assholes are trying to do is going to work.
John Oliver. On his TV show the other night, he explained why France will endure.
If you're in a war of culture and lifestyle with France, good luck. Because go ahead, bring your bankrupt ideology. They'll bring Jean-Paul Sartre, Edith Piaf, fine wine, Gaulois cigarettes, Camus, Camembert, Madeleines, Macarons, Marcel Proust, and the Croquembouche. The Croquembouche. You just brought a philosophy of rigorous self-abnegation to a pastry fight, my friend.
And out of France, a cartoon has been making the rounds online this week. It's by one of the surviving Charlie Hebdo cartoonists, Johan Zwaar. His cartoon says, "Friends from the whole world, thank you for hashtag pray for Paris. But we don't need more religion. Our faith goes to music, kisses, life, champagne and joy." Exactly. Culture and art and entertainment and reason and delight in the beautiful, motley, hurly-burly of cosmopolitan cities. In those things, I am a true believer.
It's the life of Paris. Paris without culture is nothing.
They can't stop us. They can't. We'll still be there. It's impossible for us to stop because this is also what we love. And they can't stop us from loving each other, from loving what we love.
Thanks to Colette Davidson for bringing us those voices from Paris. We'll be back in a minute with more stories of living, breathing culture here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. This week, like everybody, I have been thinking a lot about Paris, and I've been thinking about how a city and culture mends itself after horrific acts of violence. Here in the United States in 1969, not long after the assassination of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and as the country was seeming to unravel, one record album famously urged everybody to just get along. Sly and the Family Stone's album, Stand.
Are you ready?
Ready?
Are you ready?
Ready?
It was a blend of soul and funk and psychedelia and sheer glee.
Clap your hands.
The band was proudly and for the time unusually multiracial, and Stand features some of their most enduring and political music.
some of those songs had provocative lyrics, too. So if you're listening to this with, I don't know, your Cub Scout troop, heads up. To tell the story of this seminal album, Sly Stone deferred to the band's guitarist.
My name is Frederick Stewart. I am Sly Sylvester Stewart's only brother.
Sly Stone's biographer.
My name is Jeff Kalis, and I'm the author of I Want to Take You Higher, The Life and Times of Sly and the Family Stone.
And a funk legend.
My name is George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic, sometimes known as P-Funk All-Stars.
Cross for you to bear, things to go through if you're going anywhere.
Sly had messages in everything he said. When he said stand, it was demanding. It meant get up.
The song Stand really is putting you in a position of standing up for what you believe in, standing up for your joy. This was like a civil rights anthem made rock friendly.
When Stan came out, everybody looking to be free. Black, women, gay. There was a whole lot of freedom being fought for at that time.
Sing a simple song.
Sly was able to be very artsy-fartsy with this stuff. In that funk, simple groove, he was able to create standards and still be funky. I mean, Simple Song was the epitome of funk songs, and it was a pretty pop message.
Sing a simple song. Try a little, don't break me off so far, Tito.
My mom and my dad taught us right from wrong. Never looked at black and white. You know, we just went to school on the weekends. We went to the parks. It's sort of like all of us played together, you know, all the colors of the rainbow. It wasn't until I was in the 12th grade that I ever seen a race riot.
Don't call me nigger.
So the songs, I think, help people see what we saw and how we lived and how things could be.
Well, I was down across the country.
Sly's blackness was intact with his music. His social awareness was from a street point of view, but highly intellectual. He had messages, social, political, and then straight street.
I Want to Take You Higher has so much in it. There's very much a feeling of sharing. Everybody gets to sing. Every one of the individual instruments gets its own thing. How many rock and roll songs can anybody name where that goes on?
When he got to Woodstock, the fringes flying in the air, Take You Higher was like what Woodstock was all about. It was the epitome of that rock era. That was the top of the mountain.
Woodstock was absolutely phenomenal.
I think it was a special realization for Sly and the band when they came on in the middle of the night and saw themselves waking up fields full of thousands and thousands of hippies and saw this reflection back of these happy faces. You know, they recognize their power.
If people knew my brother the way I know him, he's probably the least confident of the whole band. He's probably the one that needs the biggest great job, man, because he is so critical of his own material.
Sometimes I'm right, but I can be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The preacher, the banker, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in. I am everyday people, yeah, yeah.
You know, sometimes I'm right, and I can't be wrong. I mean, everyone can relate to the songs that are on here. I'm forever grateful.
Sly Stone represents everything that I love about music and writing music and singing music. Sly Stone as my man.
That was George Clinton, Freddie Stone, and Jeff Kalis talking about the 1969 album Stand by Sly and the Family Stone. The album was inducted this year into the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. Our story was produced by Devin Strolovich for BMP Audio. What Sly Stone called everyday people, a century earlier, Karl Marx had called the proletariat. There's a new novel that takes one of those proles and imagines a backstory for her. Mrs. Engels, by the writer Gavin McRae, focuses on a little-known character in Marx's orbit, Lizzie Burns. As sometimes happens with historical fiction, McRae had very few facts to go on.
She was illiterate, so she left no diaries or letters. So we know very little about her. She's kind of a ghost in the historical record. She wafts in and out of drawing rooms, but we know very little about her herself.
Lizzie's older sister, Mary Burns, had lived with Marx's benefactor and collaborator, Frederick Engels. She died, and after Mary's death, Lizzie replaced her sister as Engels' lover.
The background is in 1842, Engels was sent to Manchester to do a two-year internship at his family's cotton mill. And as expected, this prepared Engels for a business life in the cotton industry. The unintended consequence was that he became a communist and aided by the two sisters, Mary and Lizzie Burns. And so after work every night, he would do what other mill men would not. He entered the slums, and his guide, as he walked through the slums and surveyed it, was Mary Burns. How he met her historically is unknown. In my book, they meet because Mary and Lizzie are workers in his mill.
Right.
Mary has a relationship with Engels until she dies, and the feelings that he has for Mary transfer either before that or around that time to Lizzie. There's an ambiguity in my book as to when exactly his feelings for Lizzie began.
Right. This is your first novel.
It is.
You're in your on the far side of mid-30s.
Thanks, Kurt.
What took you so long to write your first novel?
Well, I was doing what all writers do, traveling the world, taking drugs.
Oh, there you go. You mean accumulating life experience that you could turn into fiction?
No. I left Ireland when I was 21 and have been traveling more or less ever since. And in my 30s at some stage, I woke up to the idea that I needed to do this if I was going to do it. So
right.
In my kind of first years of my 30s, I began to scribble things down. And then in my mid-30s, I started to think, well, maybe I could write a novel.
As all good novels must, yours has a great opening line or lines. Would you read from the beginning?
Sure. So it begins with a manifesto by Lizzie. No one understands men better than the women they don't marry. And my own opinion, but known only to God, is that the difference between one man and another doesn't amount to much. It's no matter what line he's in or which ideas he follows, whether he's sweet-tempered or ready-witted, a dab at one business or the next, for there isn't so much in any of that, and you won't find a man that hasn't something against him. What matters over and above the contents of his character? What makes the difference between sad and happy straits for she who must put her life in his keeping is the mint that jingles in his pockets. In the final reckoning, the good and the bad come to an even naught, and the only thing left to recommend him is his money.
That was Gavin McRae reading from his new novel, Mrs. Engels. Even after Lizzie has been with him for years, she describes herself in your novel as, quote, a pauper woman on an expensive couch, which is a great line. So as you imagine her, she never fully embraced her new role in life.
No, she's always going to be uncomfortable with it. You know, I think as the novel progresses, she becomes increasingly entitled, shall we say.
Right.
But there remains discomfort, and there remains the eye that has seen outside of this bourgeois world and knows the other world.
Right. Engels has always fascinated me completely. Mm-hmm. This young man running his family milling business, becoming mm-hmm. a radical anti-capitalist, but then keeping his day job for decades as an industrialist so he can subsidize Mr. Communism.
Milking the system from the inside.
Exactly. He is the dialectical man. But you weren't tempted to novelize Frederick Engels?
No.
Because?
I was interested in Marx and Engels for a number of reasons, but I wasn't interested in writing about them until I came across Lizzie Burns.
Huh.
Actually, I came across Lizzie in the review of a biography of Engels. I then subsequently bought the biography and then saw how little was known about her, and I took it from there.
As you depicted, and it is plausible to me, that Engels's relationship with these working-class women made him feel in solidarity with the proletariat in ways he couldn't have otherwise,
yes.
That they were sort of anti-trophy wives.
I think they gave him, as you know, guides through Manchester to
sure.
the working class world of Manchester, they gave him the material for his Nation to Communist Theory.
Right. But that's different than living with them and essentially marrying and finally
yes.
actually marrying, right? I mean, there was something, there was a vanity involved, don't you think?
Yes. Engels was a womanizer.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that.
And of course, Engels continued to live a comfortable life
yes.
with his working class consorts and subsidized Marx's comfortable life.
And he never actually actively did anything to improve the conditions in his family's mill.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of the ultimate paradox is the charitable word. Hypocrisy would be the less charitable word.
I mean, the way Marx and Engels saw things was that capitalism was a global order. Local skirmishes, local change is not going to, you know, overturn it. What is needed is an international global movement of workers between all countries. So in a sense, they let themselves off the hook
right.
by saying that nationalisms or local conspiracies were useless.
And I guess if history is going to do this anyway, we just
yes.
wait for history to do its thing.
It was inevitable. Yeah, in their eyes, it was inevitable.
Yeah.
So.
I read that you imagined in the abstract that your first novel would not be a mm-hmm. researched historical novel, not about mm-hmm. a woman behind the man. And now I also read that you're planning more novels about women in the lives of famous communists. Talk about that.
Yeah. I'm working on a novel in which Madame Mao is a character. She's a character that whose destiny in somehow affects the destiny of a theatre family in London. So I want to work with a different world, a different universe, but with some of the same themes kind of running through.
Yeah, that which is an interesting choice that you would return to. Oh yes, women behind communists.
Yeah, the next book isn't so much women behind communists, but it's certainly women in communism.
Right.
My interest in communism is really an interest in people who believe they know what's best for themselves in the world.
Right.
So it's a really interesting thing to play with if you're interested in the idea of belief or religion. And the frustrations that's, you know, the suffering that goes with having religion and belief, then communism is an interesting thing to explore.
My sense of your take on Marxism and communism, I guess, via Lizzie's take, is that you don't fully embrace any theory that reduces individual people to historical
No.
economic abstractions. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. And I think, you know, having rejected my Catholic upbringing, there's one thing I thank my Catholic upbringing for, and it's the healthy and very strong nose I have for, should I curse?
Sure.
For bullshit. So, so I see communism in the same way. You know, there's so much that Marx writes that's absolutely compelling. However, Marx disregarded the individual. This idea of the proletariat ignores the difference between workers, their racial distinctions, their sexual distinctions, their local struggles, their local needs, their everyday needs, and it subsumes them into this global struggle.
Right.
I'm not quite sure I'm entirely comfortable with
that. And of course, what you're saying is that Marxism, or maybe any ism, is the opposite of what a fiction writer is trying to do about specific places and specific people.
I mean, I think if you have an ism as a writer, that's exactly what you should be questioning.
Yeah. Well, I very much enjoyed the book, and Gavin McRae, thank you for coming on to talk about it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Gavin McRae's novel, Mrs. Engels, is out now.
She said, I want to live like common people. I want to do whatever common people do. Want to sleep with common people. I want to sleep with common people like you.
Still ahead this hour, what if Princess Leia's most degraded moment is actually Star Wars' great feminist scene?
Let's be clear, she strangles the guy who is keeping her as a sex slave with her own chains.
Princess Leia, the Hutt Slayer. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. It's almost that time of year when George Bailey goes running through the black and white streets of Bedford Falls, on repeat, endlessly.
Yay! Hello, Bedford Falls!
So we've got a challenge for you. We want you to make your own contribution to the holiday film genre. It can be dramatic, funny, romantic, absurd, whatever. The only rule, it's got to be 30 seconds or shorter. The comedian and actor Jenny Slate is the judge for our festival, which we're calling It's a Wonderful Short. We've gotten some excellent entries already, such as a few very short, very twisted cartoons involving troublemaking elves. Dan Abdo and Jason Patterson are the animators, and I've got them on the phone now. Hello, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And you've known each other a long time, so this is not a recent collaboration.
Yeah, we went to high school together.
Yeah, we grew up in Montpelier, Vermont, so we go way back.
How cute. So, Jason, you are a New Yorker cartoonist, and the two of you together a couple of years ago created the Nickelodeon cartoon series Rocket Monkeys. So you're not amateurs.
No, we've been doing this for a while. We had our own studio called Cannonball Studios.
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
In the comments on your entry, you wrote that you make these cartoons every year. So this is kind of what you do instead of sending out Christmas cards?
Yeah, totally. It's a different sort of holiday each year.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, we love Christmas, like, just as much as it is, like, saccharine sweet, which, like, we don't love. So it's kind of like a both, like, a love letter to Christmas and a bit of a comment on it.
These cartoons are very short, about 10 seconds apiece. Into which you cram a lot of humor. What are the germs? How do they start? Is it like coming up with a cartoon for the New Yorker? Like, oh, what if the elves were X or Y?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times we'll start drawing the elf, you know, doing something pretty banal, like wrapping a present, and then we kind of extrapolate on, well, if the present he's making is a little dollhouse, is there somebody inside that little dollhouse? And then kind of taking the next logical leap, well, the little doll might be taking a shower and the elf might kind of enjoy getting that glimpse of that. So it really is kind of, like you said, maybe starting someplace with a little bit of heart and then just kind of taking that weird U-turn.
So do you have any advice for people out there making their own super short holiday films for our challenge?
I mean, I think one thing that's worked for us with these has just been quantity over quality. Like, I think it's just like, you can just make one and it might not be the best thing in the world, but it's okay because you can make another one really quickly.
Dan and Jason, thank you both.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. This was a blast.
You can watch Dan and Jason's cartoons and enter your own very brief holiday movie at studio360.org/wonderfulshort. It can be live action, claymation, shadow puppets, all humans, all animals, as long as it lasts 30 seconds or less. You've got until December 7th to enter, so get on it. As you undoubtedly know, and if you don't, I am sincerely interested in hearing from you. A new Star Wars movie is coming out next month. The Force Awakens will begin yet another trilogy about another generation of heroes and villains in that far, far away galaxy. But what's definitely going to get me into the theater is that the main actors from the original Star Wars movies are also in this one. My Studio 360 colleague Eric Malinsky has been observing the Star Wars phenomenon closely, maybe a little bit too closely, for a very long time. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
I very clearly remember the first time I saw the first Star Wars. I found it extraordinary. I thought, oh, this kids movie, this little stupid space movie that I'm not going to like is extraordinary. The special effects are amazing. I felt like a child again, and I was barely out of childhood. You were a little kid, I guess, when you saw it.
Yeah. I mean, I find that completely fascinating because I feel like for my generation, I had this experience that many people had. For me, it was my 6th birthday. My parents, we all went out to dinner in downtown Boston, the top of the Prudential Center, went across the street to see Star Wars. And so my mind was like a blank slate. And so I think it's so fascinating to hear from somebody who was a young adult who came to Star Wars with, you know, the knowledge of culture and the world and then seeing it fresh that way.
Obviously, we've now had 49 Star Wars movies in the interim. Or actually, how many?
Well, we've had 6 plus some TV series,
right,
and a gazillion novels and comic books that are all supposedly filling in video games that are filling in the gaps between,
right,
all those 6 movies.
And so there is a canon of Star Wars stuff, phrases, ideas.
Mm.
It's not quite – maybe it is like Shakespeare in the modern era in terms of –
Give it 400 years.
Of giving so many phrases and constructions to the – culture, but are there any of those that stuck with you, that fascinate you?
The Force definitely is something that interests me a lot. And that struck you too when you first saw it, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if when I first saw it, but shortly after, and I realized, oh, I like this idea. I'm not a religious person, but this Force idea, that I can get down with. And thinking about it later, I realized it was the epitome of this new, vague, amorphous, new age idea that there are energies and it's just a matter of getting your mind in the right space. So I think it was a brilliant part of the, scheme.
Yeah. And then the other side, I mean, how often do you hear people say turning to the dark side? I mean, it's just part of
or the Death Star.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm always fascinated in politics and in sports how often people use this sort of evil empire terminology.
Yeah.
And then one day you wake up and you discover that somebody else has said that, no, you see, in our story, you're the evil empire. And,
right,
and it's kind of shocking sometimes because,
yes,
we all want to see ourselves as the rebels.
Evil empire is in the eye of the beholder.
It's very true. Another one that really interests me is Princess Leia's gold bikini. Do you remember that from Return of the Jedi?
I saw it, but I remember that she had – it was like little bits of gold turned into a bikini.
Yeah. It was a metal bikini. It's become really iconic.
I think I was married by then, so I probably wasn't allowed to pay attention.
I was 12. I talked to this guy, actually, Adam Buxton, and when Return of the Jedi came to his hometown in the UK, he was 13, and he saw it with his family, and he loved it. But his father
– My dad was saying – I must say, I found the whole beginning part with her dressed up as a slave extremely sinister.
He's referring to the scene where Princess Leia is captured by this grotesque giant slug called Jabba the Hutt.
One of the great creations of the Star Wars trilogy.
Yes, and she is forced to wear this gold metal bikini and a collar that is chained up to Jabba.
Yeah. Oh, I can't bear to watch.
And when Adam saw those scenes, like a lot of 13-year-old boys, well, you know.
My nether regions were beginning to suddenly come into their own and wake up. You know, it's like, oh, wow, look at her.
Jump to the present. Now, Adam is a father. His 5-year-old daughter wants to watch the Star Wars trilogy.
My memory of it was that it was really quite tame. You know, it's got the Ewoks in it.
Although after she saw it, Adam began to worry that he had exposed his daughter to something sinister. But she wasn't disturbed by Princess Leia in the gold bikini. She actually loved it. And that disturbed him.
I know Jabba the Hutt is a baddie.
Jabba the Hutt.
Yes. But he actually chose for Leia to dress up as a slave. He actually chose a really nice dress.
Adam is a comedian, and he records a lot of his life to use as material. So he recorded this conversation and turned it into an animated short, which aired on British TV.
But you wouldn't want to be a slave, though, right?
No, I just would want to escape and just keep on wearing that. Because it looks really nice.
So your plan, if you were in Jabba the Hutt's palace...
Mm-hmm, I would just be rescued and then I would ask them if I could keep his dress up.
The internet didn't think it was so cute.
Some people saying that I had indoctrinated her. I don't know if that's true. I hope it's not true. But for whatever reason, she just naturally has gravitated towards a lot of those things, you know?
A lot of women do. I mean, it amazes me when I see pictures from Comic-Con of dozens of women born after Return of the Jedi came out, all dressed as Slave Leia, posing around a big plaster Jabba the Hutt. And yes, Slave Leia is the official trademark name of the gold bikini. And it's become the dominant image of Leia, from bobbleheads to thumb drives to aprons to action figures. Not her white robe and her cinnamon bun hairdo. Not her combat gear in the Battle of Endor. It's all Slave Leia. Princess Leia fans started protesting. This is not the right message to send to girls. And this month, Disney announced that it would no longer sell any Slave Leia merchandise, which prompted a counter-backlash. Annalee Newitt is an editor at Ars Technica, and she thinks we need to take this controversy with a grain of salt.
The fact is, people are always going to want to see their favorite characters in a sexy pose, especially if they actually are sexy, so we can't weed that out of our brains. That's just kind of part of being human.
The babe in the bikini is a trope of the sci-fi fantasy genre, from Barbarella to Red Sonja in Conan the Barbarian to Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
All we need to do is just make sure that we have both men and women, cheesecake and beefcake, and then we're fine.
Part of what I love about Carrie Fisher's acting in the sequences in the movie when she's in that costume is how much contempt she has for the whole affair.
Alyssa Rosenberg writes about pop culture for The Washington Post.
Also, let's be clear, she strangles the guy who is keeping her as a sex slave with her own chains.
So Slave Leia is actually a sex symbol and a feminist icon. Well, Carrie Fisher didn't see it that way. She told Newsweek the costume is what supermodels will eventually wear in the seventh ring of hell. At a ceremony honoring George Lucas, she said,
"But like any abused child wearing a metal bikini changed to a giant slug about to die, I keep coming back for more."
In Interview magazine, she talked with Daisy Ridley, who's in the new Star Wars movies, and Fisher told her, "You should fight for your outfit. Don't be a slave like I was." Donna Dickens writes for the site HitFix, and she was always bothered by the fact that Leia has no dialogue when she's chained up.
So you have Princess Leia in the first movie, who is sassy to Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin. She has no fear. She will make fun of them to their faces.
"Darth Vader, only you could be so bold. The Imperial Senate will not sit still for this. When they hear you've attacked a diplomat..."
They bring in a torture droid, a literal torture droid with, like, syringe. And of course we don't see it because it's PG movie, but Darth Vader is unable to break her. This is like James Bond levels of mental fortitude. So for Princess Leia to be in a slave bikini in Jabba the Hutt's palace, completely cowed and silent and submissive. What are the implications of what had to have happened off screen for her to break like that?
What's really bizarre about this subject is that the subtext couldn't be more serious and disturbing, but the context is completely silly and ludicrous. And this didn't sink in for me until last year, when a friend asked if I thought Jabba the Hutt had sexually assaulted Princess Leia. I mean, I had naively thought Jabba was keeping her like a pet, you know, with a leash and a collar. My friend said, well, if that's the case, why did she choke him in the end with such rage? And suddenly I had this like freaky R-rated version of Return of the Jedi in my head.
There was never a time when it didn't occur to me that she was just not being molested, that was part of what was happening in the subtext of this sequence. And then, of course, her killing Jabba the way that she did, I think, would resonate with anyone who has ever suffered abuse and hoped to take them out in a moment of rage and opportunity.
Did this resonate with you in any personal way? I mean, not to get too personal, but were you ever in any situations that in any way were kind of disturbing or creepy like that?
The reason it resonated with me is my mother's first husband was very abusive, and she made it very clear to me as a child that, you know, this, you don't take this. Like, if something like this happens, you know, you fight back. These are the things you do to make sure that, you know, you never end up in a situation like I was in.
Then she started questioning why Leia was in a bikini to begin with.
To be honest, there's no reason for a slug monster to want humanoid-shaped women in sexy costumes. Like, forcing Jabba to find human women sexually attractive because that's what the audience finds sexually attractive.
It also puts you on the same side as Jabba the Hutt in objectifying her, right? It's a sexual image that deliberately exploits any attraction you feel to it by putting you on not just the side of evil, but with the most physically grotesque villain in the movies.
Alyssa Rosenberg thinks that is subversive in the best possible way.
I mean, I think that's a pretty powerful feminist cinematic moment, whether George Lucas intended it that way or not.
Donna did find a way to live with the costume. She just calls it by another name.
I refer to it as the Hutt Slayer Leia costume because that's what she does in it. She slays Hutts.
Thanks to Eric Molinsky for that story. By the way, Eric Molinsky is also the host of Imaginary Worlds, a terrific podcast about science fiction and fantasy. And wouldn't you know it, Eric's got not one, not two, not three, not four, but a five-part series on Star Wars running on his podcast right now. So what do you all think about Princess Leia's metal bikini? Harmless cheesecake, actually offensive, or iconic feminism? Let us know at studio360.org. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. If you're a regular listener and as wise as most of our listeners are, you'll leave us a review at iTunes.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Molinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
I got a chocolate bar.
I got a quarter.
I got five pieces of candy. What did you get, Charlie Brown?
I got a rock.
KRP!
I got a rock.
Deconstructing Charles Schultz's peanuts. Next time in Studio 360...
I got a rock.
From PRI.